Chapter 11. What happens just before the end? Daniel, chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I, stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia. And the fourth shall be far richer than they all, and by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all, against the realm of Grecia. In this chapter, there are no symbols or figures to confuse us. As simply as one man could describe something to another, the angel tells Daniel the news of events coming in world history. The angel Gabriel helped King Darius in his reign. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, as the rivers of water. He turneth it whithersoever he will. The Lord sends his angels today to help the rulers of the world, who strive to preserve peace, so that the work of God can prosper unhindered. The three kings who stood up or reigned in Persia were Cambyses, son of Cyrus, Smerdis, and Darius Hystaspes. The fourth was Xerxes, richer than them all. It was he who foolishly stirred up war against the young and vigorous kingdom of Greece. Only the most important events are brought to our attention in this prophecy. Often hundreds of years intervene between verses. We view world history as one, standing on a high peak, looks over a range of hills and mountains, discerning through the haze only the tops of the hills lifted above the fog, the valleys hidden from his view. The next verse skips over the nine descendants of Xerxes, and introduces us to Alexander the Great, Daniel, chapter 11, verses 3 and 4, and a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken, and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. And not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. Alexander did according to his will. Man's will always leads him into trouble. Alexander's will led him into alcoholism. He died suddenly in 323 before Christ, leaving his Grecian kingdom to those who would fight for it. His son, or posterity, received no crown. In a short time his entire family had been murdered. Of what value were his riches and glory? Four kingdoms emerged out of the wars and wreckage: Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. Two of them, the king of the territory north of Palestine, and the king of the territory south of Palestine, become the important kings who star in this drama. This geographical designation, early in the vision, seems to define throughout the chapter the identity of the kings of the north and the south, if we keep in mind the law of first mention, Daniel, chapter 11, verses 5 and 6, and the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes. And he shall be strong above him, and have dominion, his dominion shall be a great dominion. And in the end of years they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm. Neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. Cassander and Lysimachus at first ruled over the west and north, but fell before Seleucus, who then became the king of the north. In the meantime, Ptolemy of Egypt is known as the king of the south. These two kingdoms fight on for centuries, and they reappear at the end of the chapter. The only way we can reasonably understand this chapter is to identify the king of the north as that power which rules or occupies the territory which had been the northern area of Alexander's kingdom. And the king of the south is that power which ruled or occupied the part that was the southern area. Dynasties and families, kings and rulers, may change. Political powers may be replaced by others. Centuries may go by, but the land territories remain the same. Ptolemy Philadelphus of Egypt, the king of the south, made an agreement with Antiochus Theos of Syria, the king of the north, to give him his daughter Berenice in marriage, requiring Antiochus to put away his first wife, Laodice. The motive was to unite the two warring royal families. But it seems God never blesses adultery. She shall not retain the power of the arm. The trick to cement their friendship failed. Laodice finally poisoned her husband, Berenice herself was murdered, and they that brought her were slain with her, including her son. Do adulterous unions often end in disaster? Daniel, chapter 11, verses 7-9, But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail, and shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods, with their princes, and with their precious vessels of silver and of gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom, and shall return into his own land. The branch out of her roots was her own brother, Ptolemy Ergetes. When he came to the throne, he immediately led an army to the territory of the north to avenge the murder of his sister, crushed his enemies, and raided the wealth of his captives. The spoil he carried back to Egypt. The mention of Egypt makes certain that we are to understand that country to be the king of the south. By analogy, our understanding of the king of the north is confirmed. Daniel, chapter 11, verses 10 and 11, But his sons shall be stirred up, and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come, and overflow, and pass through, then shall he return, and be stirred up, even to his fortress. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude. But the multitude shall be given into his hand. Hatred and revenge dominated the world. Seleucus' sons determined to avenge the conquest of their father's kingdom, and prepared to invade Egypt, reconquering their father's kingdom on the way. Naturally, Ptolemy Philopater of Egypt was furious at this new attack, and went forth to battle. Again Egypt emerged victorious in arms, at the Battle of Raphia, in 217 before Christ. Daniel, chapter 11, verses 12 and 13, And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. For the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. Ptolemy, not knowing God nor understanding the pride of his human heart, gloried in his victory. Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. He had crushed mighty armies. But his own passions and lusts crushed him in turn. Disgusted with their shamefully lewd ruler, his own subjects rebelled against him. He began a heartless persecution of the Jews. He died by destroying himself, leaving his infant son, Ptolemy Epiphanes, to the throne. He was joined by many who stood up against Egypt, including King Philip of Macedon, who proposed to divide Egypt's kingdom among other kings. Egypt's day of glory now comes to an end. Daniel, chapter 11, verses 14-16, And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south, also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision. but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come, and cast up a mount, and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. The robbers of thy people in the Hebrew is the breakers or oppressors of thy people, the Jews. The vision here is chazon, referring us back to Daniel's vision of the little horn. It was indeed at this time that the Romans began to exalt themselves toward becoming a world empire. But the angel encourages God's people, as if to say, "Don't be dismayed, the time must come when they shall fall. Look to the end, those who oppose God's truth will not prosper forever." By this time, Egypt had come under the protection of the Romans. Antiochus, the king of the north, aided by Philip of Macedon, had determined to wrest all of Egypt's territory from Ptolemy, the infant king. The Romans warned him to let Egypt alone, but he refused to listen. He overran Palestine and began to harass Egypt's possessions in Asia Minor. A second and a third time the Romans warned him to desist, but he plunged on in his war of conquest. Even the well-fortified cities of Gaza and Sidon, the most fenced cities, finally surrendered to his might. When Antiochus invaded Greece itself in 197 before Christ, the Romans were at last compelled to fight him, and defeated him at Magnesia. Antiochus fled back to Syria, like a dog with his tail between his legs. He was forced to accept humiliating terms of surrender offered by the Romans. In this way, the Romans are the new power introduced, as he that cometh against him and he that shall do according to his own will. The Romans entered the glorious land of Palestine, in 161 before Christ, conquering it. In 63 before Christ, year by year, Rome is growing in power. Now she has already conquered Macedon and Thrace, Syria and Judea. Now all that remains of Alexander's proud kingdom is the king of the south, Egypt. Rome must now conquer that kingdom also. Daniel, chapter 11, verse 17, "He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him." A very beautiful woman, Cleopatra, the daughter of women, played a prominent part in giving Egypt to Rome. Her father had been king of Egypt. Before he died in 51 before Christ, he decreed that the crown of Egypt and its rulership should be left to his son and daughter to share jointly between them. He also specified that until the two children were old enough to reign, he would place them under the guardianship of the Romans. But the two soon began to quarrel, for the elder, Ptolemy, had deprived his sister Cleopatra of her rights. Julius Caesar, the Roman consul, demanded that the two appear before him so he could decide which was to be favored in judgment. Cleopatra, now a grown young woman, had heard that Caesar was a licentious man, and determined to win his favor by appealing to his lustful passions. She had herself wrapped in a large carpet and carried to the Roman consul's apartment as a gift for Caesar. The bundle containing the beautiful girl was carried into Caesar's private apartments. When he opened it, out stepped the enticingly dressed Cleopatra, ready to charm and seduce the Roman to give judgment in her favor. Caesar liked what she did, and yielded. In the war that followed, Ptolemy was killed, so Caesar conquered Egypt. But she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. Cleopatra being fickle, she soon joined herself to Caesar's enemy, Antony, and used all her power against Rome. Daniel, chapter 11, verses 18 and 19. After this, shall he turn his face unto the isles, and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land. But he shall stumble and fall, and not be found. The important facts in these verses are that Caesar should take part in another war, after which his own reproach should turn upon himself. He should return to the fort of his own land, the city of Rome, and there stumble and fall. In 47 before Christ, Caesar entered Rome in triumph, where he was showered with every kind of reward and honor, including the title of dictator for life. Rome had up to this time been a republic. Caesar's enemies now feared he would become a king or emperor, and change the age-old form of Roman government. In March, 44 before Christ, when Caesar was least expecting it, he stumbled and fell, being murdered in the Senate House by his former friends. What shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Thus ended the life of another of the world's most successful and powerful men of arms. Heaven was watching, for the birth of the Son of God was near. Daniel, chapter 11, verse 20, then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger, nor in battle. Augustus Caesar, his successor, was a man of peace, in contrast to Julius Caesar, a man of war. He was famous as a raiser of taxes. Luke speaks of a decree from Caesar Augustus, that all the world should be taxed, at the time that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Augustus' days were the glory of the kingdom of Rome. Peace was universal, corruption had been curbed, justice was maintained, and learning was promoted. He died a few years after the birth of Christ, not at the hand of assassins as happens so often, but peacefully in bed. Daniel, chapter 11, verses 21 and 22, and in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably, and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and shall be broken. Yea, also the prince of the covenant. Augustus was succeeded by a truly vile person, Tiberius Caesar. He obtained the kingdom by flatteries in a peaceful way. When he became emperor, he revealed an unspeakably vile character, murdering innocent people, dissembling and flattering his enemies before arresting them to kill them. Seneca says Tiberius maintained one continual drunken spell from the time he began to drink until he died. But Tiberius was washed away before the flood of wrathful opposition which his vileness had aroused. In his 78th year of age, he was murdered. Like a flood, he had overflown many. Now the flood washed him away, and broke him. But another was broken during the reign of Tiberius Caesar, the Prince of the Covenant, the Christ, the Son of God, mentioned as the Messiah the Prince, in Daniel, chapter 9, verses 25 to 27. This was the one great event of all world history. Rising above the stormy waves of a sea of corrupt human history, stands this eternal rock of ages, the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, whence we have everlasting salvation. Please note carefully that the death of Christ, the Prince of the Covenant, confirms beyond all doubt the interpretation of these verses in Daniel 11. Christ died only once, under only one government, under only one Roman emperor, Tiberius Caesar. Like an expert surveying land, We see this landmark as making certain our understanding so far of the history in this prophecy. People from the four quarters of the earth gathered around Christ in his last hours. The Greeks, representing the cultured and proud of earth, came saying, "We would see Jesus." The thief, representing the fallen failures of human life, repented as he was crucified with Jesus. The Roman soldier, a European, was convicted and said, "Truly this was the Son of God." Simon of Cyrene from North Africa bore his heavy cross to Calvary, the first of hundreds of thousands of Africans who since have gladly shared the sufferings of Christ. Daniel, chapter 11, verses 23-26, "And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up, and shall become strong with the small people. He shall enter peaceably even upon the fattest places of the province. And he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey, and spoil, and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. And he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Yea, they that feed of the portion of his meat shall destroy him, and his army shall overflow. And many shall fall down slain." Thus far, the angel has taken us step by step in world history, down to the time of the crucifixion of Christ, the Prince of the Covenant. This came near the close of the 70 weeks, or 490 years of chapter 9. Verse 23 should begin a new paragraph in our Bibles, for the angel is now taking us on another journey, this time bringing us down to the final era of the work of God on earth and the everlasting triumph of his church. But he backtracks to the time when the Jewish nation made a covenant with the Romans, after the league made with him, and shows us that from the time that Rome assumed the protection of Judea, she began to develop from a small army, in a clever way. This covenant with the Jews was made in 161 before Christ, before the days of Rome's glory. From that time, Rome's rise to undisputed world leadership was indeed a miracle. Whereas most kingdoms are established by war and conquest, various kings bequeathed their crowns to the Romans in peace and by choice. Distant nations learned of the wisdom and justice of the Romans, and invited their protection. Rome further did what no nation had ever previously done, divided the taxes and spoil among its conquered or subjugated peoples. It was an attempt at just and benevolent government for the good of all people. It was later that Rome became cruel. The stronghold is doubtless the capital city of Rome, from which he will prosper in war and craft as long as heaven permits. The time is considered by some to be a year of prophetic time and symbol, that is, 360 years literally. The angel is still going back to events following the league made with the Jews in 161 before Christ. We come to the war between Rome and the king of the south, or Egypt. Mark Antony and Augustus Caesar were contending for the sole rulership of Rome. Antony had entrenched himself in Egypt, where he had yielded himself captive to the lustful appeal of Egypt's queen Cleopatra. Antony and Cleopatra together assembled a fleet of warships. The kings of Thrace and Asia Minor joined them against Caesar Augustus and the Roman soldiers. Wealth, numbers, and power were on their side. But the inspired prophecy declared that the king of the south shall not stand. At the most important part of the sea battle off Actium, on September 2, 31 before Christ, Cleopatra suddenly became frightened and sailed away in her ship. Antony, foolishly infatuated with her, followed, and thus abandoned the victory to Augustus Caesar. Those who fed of the portion of Antony's meat, the land armies and generals who were fighting on his side, became disgusted with what he had done, went over to join the armies of Caesar. In the end, no one remained loyal to the foolish Antony, even Cleopatra betrayed him. He took his own life in despair. Daniel, chapter 11, verse 27, "And both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table. But it shall not prosper, for yet the end shall be at the time appointed." These two, Antony and Caesar, had professed to be loyal friends, but inwardly, were enemies contending for the throne. In order to cement their friendship, Antony had married Caesar's sister. But none of their attempts to unite prospered. Daniel, chapter 11, verse 28, "Then shall he return into his land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant. And he shall do exploits, and return to his own land. We shall avoid confusion, if we remember that the king mentioned in these verses does not necessarily refer to a single individual, but to a kingdom or a power prominent in history. Caesar returned to Rome with great glory and much booty from his conquest, his triumphal procession requiring 3 days to pass. We learn that his heart, that of Rome, shall be against the Holy Covenant. Written for the Jews, this describes how the Romans were against them, to whom they understood he had made a Holy Covenant. The Roman general Titus besieged the city of Jerusalem for 5 months. So terrible was the famine that some of the Jewish women ate their own children. This was in fulfillment of Moses' warning that should the people of God refuse to hear the greatest of all prophets, Jesus himself when he should come, they would be left without his guidance and protection. Thou shalt eat the fruit of thine own body, the flesh of thy sons and of thy daughters, which the Lord thy God hath given thee, in the siege, and in the straitness, wherewith thine enemies shall distress thee. So terrible is the result that comes upon a people, who reject the only Savior of the world. In 70 AD, Titus completely destroyed the city of Jerusalem and their magnificent temple. Daniel, chapter 11, verses 29 and 30, "At the time appointed he shall return, and come toward the south. But it shall not be as the former, or as the latter. For the ships of Shittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved, and return, and have indignation against the holy covenant, so shall he do. He shall even return, and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. But now we come to the time when Rome was weakened and corrupted. The move of the capital to Constantinople preceded the final breakup and conquest of the Roman Empire by the barbarians of Africa and Europe. In 476 AD, the legs of iron of Nebuchadnezzar's prophetic image, representing the pagan empire of Rome, now give place to the divided kingdoms of Europe, symbolized by the feet of iron and clay. Foremost among the barbarian nations that wrecked the Roman Empire were the Vandals of northern Africa. Their capital was the city of Carthage on the coast of the Mediterranean. In the Hebrew language, the name Shittim had reference to all the coasts and islands of the Mediterranean. The Vandals fought against the empire and pillaged Rome with their numerous ships, which set sail from Carthage. Rome was grieved. The glory of the pagan Roman Empire was extinguished. Now began another form of activity. The little horn power, which we met in chapter 7, verses 21 to 25, comes on stage again. The Vandals who conquered Rome, together with two other tribes, the Heruli and the Ostrogoths, opposed the rising power of the papacy. These three kingdoms were brought to our notice in chapter 7 as three of the 10 kingdoms of the fourth beast, Rome. They were to be as horns plucked up by the roots by the little horn, the papacy. Justinian, the Roman emperor, longed to conquer Carthage and the Vandals, as punishment for their raids against Rome. But he feared to start, for Rome's army was not as strong as formerly. The needed encouragement was supplied by the Roman Catholic bishop, who admonished him to conquer the Vandals, because they were considered enemies of Christ. Thus the Roman emperor began to give heed to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. The bishops had indeed forsaken the true gospel of Jesus Christ. It was for the purpose of conquering the Vandals and their friends that the emperor Justinian made his famous decree, exalting the bishop of Rome to be the head of the church, and the corrector of heretics. Thus was born the papacy in 538 AD, in remarkable fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy. The world began to enter its midnight, the noontide of the papacy. Daniel, chapter 11, verse 31, "And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall make away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate." Have you ever watched events take place on the stage at night, where a spotlight shines on the different players or actors, who at that moment are the center of attention? Daniel 11 is the stage throughout the 2300 years of Daniel, chapter 8, verse 14, and on into the time of the end. Verse by verse, the spotlight of inspired prophecy picks out for us the key power that is at that particular time the focus of God's revelation. The key is its special relation to His work on earth. Now we pass from pagan Rome to papal Rome. This verse takes us back to chapter 8, verses 11 and 12, where we read of the little horn taking up within itself the daily, and casting down truth to the ground. This verse therefore explains, chapter 8, verses 11 to 13. The capital of the Empire of Rome has now been removed to Constantinople, present-day Istanbul, and the Bishop of Rome is left as the most important person in the West. We now see the papacy taking the spotlight of prophetic attention. It is absorbing something significant, taking it up within itself, paganism, the continual in transgression. The Hebrew word arms means military might, employed to strengthen the papacy and make it supreme. The sanctuary of strength, likewise, means a dedicated place of military might. In the Hebrew, the word is mikdash, a different word than kadesh, in Daniel, chapter 8, verse 14, which can mean only God's true sanctuary. In Isaiah, chapter 16, verse 12, and Ezekiel, chapter 28, verse 18, we find that Mikdash can mean Satan's, or a pagan, sanctuary. Some scholars see this sanctuary of strength as the base or home of paganism, that is, the city of Rome that was the center of world paganism, sacked in 410 AD. The Hebrew term here cannot fit any designation of God's sanctuary in heaven. As we saw in Daniel 8, the word sacrifice is not part of the original text, which says the continual in transgression. Therefore, it refers to the continual scourge of paganism that was such a trial to God's people in exile in Babylon, and continuing on later, to the time of the papacy, which proved to become something even worse. The chasm vision in chapter 8 presented as two twin evils, the continual in transgression, and the transgression of desolation, the latter as the worse. In the vision, chasm, of Daniel, chapter 8, verses 11 to 13, the prophet saw paganism being lifted up, or incorporated, or absorbed into the little horn, the papacy. This was a unique development in world history. Several authorities comment more wisely than they possibly knew, the more Christianity, that is, Roman Catholicism, supplanted the heathen worship, the more, Did it absorb the elements of paganism? While Protestants have traditionally held to the idea of a syncretized church to help justify their existence, recent scholarship has demonstrated that the paganism of late antiquity did not die out after the 4th century, but rather attached itself to the church, reshaping it in the church's assimilation of pagan forms and Europe's subsequent plunge into the night. Paganism is a perpetual eclipse of divine grace. Many Christians live within the penumbra of this baleful eclipse. But here in chapter 11, verse 31, we see a different Hebrew verb used. Paganism is not said to be absorbed in the little horn as in chapter 8, but taken away politically and militarily, so that no earthly power could stand against the papacy. The professed followers of Christ forsook the holy covenant by which God had promised to be their power or support, and turned to obtain it from the civil government, the arms of generals and captains of armies. This prepared the way for setting up the abomination that maketh desolate, something that proved worse than the continual in transgression. The vision God gave to Daniel describes the religion of the papacy as paganism dressed in the garments of Christ. "He that heareth my word," said Jesus, "and believeth on him that sent me, hath everlasting life. He is passed from death unto life." This faith of Jesus is the opposite of the abomination that maketh desolate.